first speech made by Professor O'Connor, the sign value of the nation and the local. Please, welcome. In this place.
Can I stay here, actually?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Do you want me to use the microphone?
No.
Yeah. It depends how you prefer.
Let's see. I'll try without the microphone.
Sure.
If you can't hear me, then
A to będzie nagrywało dobrze?
Jest duże ryzyko, że to
nie
trzeba. Przestawić.
Nie będzie zbierało.
Tak? Teraz będzie zbierało, będzie blisko.
Czy
on pan jest usłyszany? Chyba. Nawet jakbyś mówił po rosyjsku, to
nie.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It's really wonderful to be here, and I'm sorry I'm the only one who doesn't speak Polish and introducing some complications because of that. I hope I'm the right person for this conference. I'll do my best. My own work has tended to be on questions of nationalism and ethnicity, more recently memory politics, and I suppose the connection between these phenomena and globalization. So I've been looking at questions of nationalism and ethnicity to some extent reacting against globalization and sort of seeing these social and political phenomena in the context of social and political change and structural transformations. And in some ways, of course, those topics, historical shifts in particular, make Warsaw about the most appropriate place to be talking about this in the first place. I was taken to the wonderful museum, to the Warsaw Uprising by Marcin yesterday, and I'll actually try and bring you in, Marcin, later on, because some of the examples I'll mention have nothing whatsoever to do with Poland, but now having seen the museum, I think there's some really interesting discussions and conversations
to be the
Warsaw Uprising. So, just a quick attempt to kind of position what I'm trying to do. I've looked at the conference aims. I'm trying to say something of interdisciplinary relevance. Obviously, I'm going to try and make theoretical reference to the literature on sign values and semiotics more generally. And my interests, I suppose, echo with your interests on the notions of identity and change and the semiotic manifestations of that. Undoubtedly, there are people in this room who know Jean Baudrillard far better than I do. So I'm going to use Baudrillard really as only one node in a much larger conceptual web, theoretical web that I'm trying to spin and weave today. So I'm going to argue that there are various other theoretical contributions, nodes that I suppose help me in thinking about globalization, ethnicity and nationalism in relation to a number of particular examples which I will have in due course. This is very small. Can anyone actually read this? Okay, doesn't matter, I can summarize it. This is my starting point, taking us back to Baudrillard. And in particular, I suppose the one particular point in Baudrillard's work where he talks about, where he sets up the distinction between the symbolic and the semiotic, and the large historical shift, the great transformation, to invoke Polanyi here, that Baudrillard talks about, the difference between a socially embedded form of consumption as subordinate to social hierarchy, as opposed to a hyper-individualized, hyper-consumerist social order that defines the late 20th century and now the 21st centuries. And I guess there is another Polish resonance here. He reminds us of Malinowski's work on the Trobriands. He reminds us of the Kula. He invokes Mao. So he sets up this distinction between the semiotic and the symbolic and the semiotic, talking about the colonization of the symbolic by the semiotic, the disappearance, but also this sense of the symbolic still haunting consumer society. Modern society, he says, is no longer governed, led, shaped by the symbolic, and yet the symbolic reappears on many different social layers and levels. Let's leave the small print behind, if we can. And let me try and connect what I've just said by way of a very clumsy summary of one part of Baudrillard's work with my own interest in globalization. I'd like to start off with by just kind of invoking Ayun Apadurai, who famously talks about globalization as being all about these international global flows. Finance, he says, flows internationally, technologies, media images, people, and what's the fifth? And the media, and media images. So we live in an era of global flows, and at the same time, Apadurai says, in this era of global flows, the global, the homogenizing force of contemporary society, and the local, sometimes read as the national, cannibalize one another. So this is, to my recollection, the first real attempt to kind of resist all the talk about McDonaldization. We were talking about globalization this morning over breakfast, Marek, weren't we? About how, you know, the argument that we're all being standardized by the global, by global capital. Along comes Apadurai, and he talks about actually something very different going on. The global and the local, he says, cannibalize one another, fight it out, in other words. So what I'm asking today is how this cannibalization of the global and the national, or the global and the local, manifests in science, manifests semiotically. What are some of the semiotic manifestations, illustrations of this process of homogeneity and resistance to homogeneity, fighting it out? What kinds of science give evidence of that cannibalization taking place? And to my mind, just as importantly, how explicit is that? How reflexive is that? Again, we were talking about this yesterday. How reflexively is Poland having its own identity conversations in a place like the Museum to the Warsaw Uprising? I'm not going to talk about that museum. I'm going to talk about a series of other symbols. But they all raise the question, how deliberately, how reflexively are we engaging with those semiotic struggles and with those signs and their messages? I can leave Pocock behind, that's not particularly important. Let me throw in the first other theoretical node that I think helps, and moving away from Baudrillard. Now, if anybody wants to ask me what's the bit of social theory, social and cultural theory that has helped me the most, or that I've found the most illuminating and the most surprising, it's one particular passage from Pierre Bourdieu's Outline of a Theory of Practice. Now, this is the text coming out of Bourdieu's early fieldwork, anthropological fieldwork in North Africa, but it's also the text in which he formulates the habitus, defines the habitus and all the rest of it. It's the text that some of Bourdieu's critics tend to focus in on the most when they try and make out that Bourdieu was good on structure but not so good on agency. And despite all those criticisms, there's a wonderful passage which I've quoted too often. I shouldn't go back to the same passage time and time again, but I find it so illuminating. And I also find it so surprising that very few people have picked up on this particular part of Bourdieu's work, where he says, well, actually, what happens is that we need to look at moments of crisis. The arrow on this diagram stands for crisis. And what happens in moments of crisis is that the habitus, this terrain of deeply ingrained dispositions, he now calls it doxa, the universe of cultural common sense, the undiscussed, that which we don't talk about. In crisis, doxa is transformed. It becomes something else. And Bourdieu argues it becomes discourse. That which we always used to take for granted all of a sudden becomes the object of reflection and of politics. So actually, discourse is a slight misnomer, misspelling. He really talks about discourses in the plural. So the result of this process of thinking about, of instilling reflection on doxa, results in a series of competing discourses, competing politics. Crisis transforms that which used to be taken for granted into something else. And I would love to hear how this plays out in the Polish context. Let me ask the main question I'm interested in today. As far as I can tell, we're currently seeing the expansion, or if you like, the diffusion of a whole series of national symbols from the domain of politics into the domain of advertising, of branding, of consumerism, into the domain of kind of consumer society in the 21st century. And I'm asking you the question whether we can talk about that process as a process that commodifies the nation. Mason, you were saying yesterday, the brand, that is, this, that, and the other. Is the nation being commodified? Or, alternatively, are these national symbols pointing towards something that somehow lies beyond commodification, beyond the market? Or perhaps more intelligently, is this really an either-or? Can we talk about this as either thorough commodification of the national, or can we talk about it as a moment of resisting global corporations? I'm Austrian. Most of my research is about Austria. This strange flag on my slide is a branding strategy of one of the less tasty Austrian beers. I don't like it at all. But over the last 10 years, it's decided to use the national flag as a branding tool, a national flag that has kind of popped up at skiing, downhill skiing races, and more recently also at national football competitions. I think when Austria played Poland in the European Union, the European competition in 2008, that symbol wasn't, for obvious reasons, particularly successful. You know, national colours obviously being shared between Austria and Poland, that really wasn't performing its role amongst the Austrian spectators. But my question is, what's going on here? Is this merely a beer company commodifying the national flag? Is it pointing towards something else? And how might we resolve this analytically? And I guess I should have said this early on. To me, there are sort of ontological and methodological questions at work here. These kinds of snapshots, I'm really only going to give you a series of images and snapshots, to me raise ontological questions. What's going on? Is there a struggle between the global and the national, the global and the local going on, or not, or something else? And methodologically, how do we decipher, how do we interpret signs like this flag? Let me move on to the next one. Now, I'm Austrian, I do most of my work in Austria, I live in the UK, for my sins, and I'm struck and struggling, actually, by the sudden explosion of the Union Jack all around me. I spent a lot of time yesterday looking around me in Warsaw, because every European country I've been to over the last 6 months, I'm confronted by consumer items that are displaying the Union Jack. This doesn't just happen in the UK, it happens in France, it happens in Germany, it happens in Austria. I only saw one guy in a museum yesterday who was carrying one of those bags with him. What's going on here, I asked myself. What is the Union Jack being commodified? Or is this pointing at something else? And I'll come back to it a little later today. And is this the same as the Austrian beer company sticking the Austrian flag on a flag that then gets woven at downhill skiing races and international football matches? I wonder. Now, to try and resolve this, and we really have a problem with my spelling, so again, I'm going to paraphrase this. I think we need to think about commodities and that which arguably lies beyond the world of commodities, to begin with. And I'm going to take us back once again to Ayun Apadarai, who famously talks about not commodities as just objects of economic value, but commodities as really tied to particular situations. So he talks about the commodity situation back in 1988. And that implies that anything might become a commodity over time, including the Austrian flag, including the Union Jack, including perhaps the Polish flag, for all I know. In the same collection of essays, Igor Kopitsov elaborates on this, and he also says, well, commodities need cultural work. They just, a commodity isn't, but it becomes a commodity due to the cultural work performed by certain social actors. And the same item, the same object, can be a commodity at one point in time and something else at another point in time. So it's a cognitive and cultural process that commodifies a given object. So that's one line of argument, and it's a line of argument that might enable us to understand the beer company, and it might enable us to understand the T-shirts and the handbags with Union Jack. But then there's another line of argument in Kopitov's essay, where he says, actually, there's something else going on. There is the extra economical, or that which isn't commodified. And he calls it, perhaps problematically, culture. Culture is that which resists commodification. Culture, he terms, or describes as a counter drive. So the market expands, the market intrudes into realms that we might have considered to be beyond commodification, and culture resists that. Kopitov gives us Durkheim. He reminds us of Durkheim's famous work on religion and the sacred, and he says culture accomplishes that sacralization in a whole range of different ways and in relation to a whole range of different objects that are considered to be taboo and beyond commodification. So to me there is something slight, not contradictory, but there's an interesting analytical tension in Kopitov's essay. On one hand he's saying things that haven't been commodified can clearly become commodified, can enter into the commodity situation, and at the same time culture resists that. Culture puts up a fight, acts as a counter drive. I wonder, thinking back to the beer company, thinking back to Union Jack, thinking back to my trip to the museum yesterday, how do we think about commodification and cultural resistance in relation to that? But I think we need a bit more in order to just make sense of the two signs, the two symbols, the two acts of commodification I've given you. I'd like to throw in Michael Billig, discourse analyst, Loughborough University, author of, to my mind, the most important work on nationalism written in the last 25 years. Actually, it's longer ago than that. It's nearly... how is my chronology? No, that's 25 years covers it. Author of Banal Nationalism, Michael Billig talks about the silent waving of flags, making or constituting the kind of taken for granted backdrop to all our lives. He talks about the process of rhetorical pointing, Greek term deixis, the use of pronouns, us and them, here and there, all the different and little rhetorical strategies we use in order to point at the nation, in order to point at the Polish nation, at the Austrian nation, at whichever national context we talk about, and how all of this tends to be taken for granted. We're back on the Bourdieuian question here. You know, what is doxa, what is habitus, and when do we start to reflect upon that which we used to take for granted? In Billig's terminology, when do we begin to reflect upon the nation? And when does banal nationalism, taken for granted nationalism, become hot nationalism? In what moments in time, in what structural contexts, and with the aid of which, in our current context, with the aid of which semiotic strategies is that transformation of the banal into the deliberate, the conscious, and the politicizing form of nationalism being negotiated? So that helps me, arguably, or helps us, arguably, to at least classify different examples of commodities and where they might fall on a spectrum of nationalisms. The second theoretical, or the next theoretical strand I'd like to throw in is Molly Andrews' very interesting sort of life historical research. There's one particular study she did on the use, the invocation of the American flag by critics and opponents of the first Gulf War. Off she went to Colorado in the States, and this was back in the early 90s, first Gulf War, and she basically picked up on the fact that both the most ardent supporters of the first Gulf War and the most principled opponents were using the American flag. So she's asking, you know, what's going on, and obviously in a semiotic context, the obvious answer is, well, it's another polysemic sign. Very different meanings are attached to the American flag by the opponents and the advocates. And I guess I'm curious to ask what happens when we begin to talk about the Union Jack, the Austrian flag, national symbols of Polish identification as polysemic signs, and when we begin to talk about how interpretations are contested, and how that might indeed happen in contexts of crisis as theorized by Bourdieu. And then the next theoretical strand is provided by Andreas Wimmer, who talks about ethnic closure, and I will come back to this a little later, or towards the end of my presentation. Ethnic closure is really the hardening of cultural, of national, of ethnic boundaries. Let me throw in a different example. I really do think this is qualitatively different. I've been kind of following the Austrian version of this for a number of years, but you've got the Italian there. I'm pretty sure there must be a similar movement in Poland. I know it goes on in France, I know it happens in Germany, in Belgium and various other places. This is the movement for fair milk prices by European farmers. Usually using the cow, covered, painted in the national colours, as a symbol calling or drawing attention to the struggles of national farmers and saying, in the current market we are no longer making ends meet and we need local consumers to be buying, in this case, Italian milk. We need to make a livelihood. What goes on in this case? Now, my proposition, and I'd like to hear what everyone thinks, is that something very different goes on here. This is not the same as the Union Jack being commodified, and this is not the same as a beer company sticking the Austrian flag on its thoroughly commodified flag. This is a emerging or sometimes very strong criticism of the global market. This is localism of a different kind. I'll say a bit more about this in due course. I'd like to introduce Stephen Goodman, who comes out of the kind of economic anthropology literature. He tells us that any economy, he starts somewhere else. He actually says, you know, the way in which we kind of line up economists on one hand and all the others on the other, you know, the divide between anthropology and economics, between cultural studies and economics doesn't work, because any economy, he says, is made up of two competing realms and domains. You've got a community domain and you've got a competition domain, and any economy needs both. You need trade, you need competition, but you also need enduring bonds. You need, Putnam's the Putnamian terminology, you need bonding social capital. You need some counterweight to the market. You need support structures. And without that, any economy would derail sooner or later. And I guess this is what I'm seeing in the Italian cow, if I can go back. I see the struggle between community and competition right here. And we can talk about EU agricultural subsidies here. We can talk about the plight of farmers in Africa and all the rest of it. We can talk about the relative comfort of the European context, and I'm obviously not talking about Greece, Italy, Portugal, and the Mediterranean struggles with austerity here. But beyond all of that, what we're seeing is a discursive invocation of a semiotic invocation of the nation as an illustration, I would argue, of community as defined by Goodman. Let me add to this by saying, but this isn't just a bottom-up act of resistance, but the global corporations are discovering the pull of the national as well. No idea how this pans out in Poland, but again, I would love to hear. Back in 2004, I first started noticing McDonald's adverts back in Austria telling consumers that McDonald's in Austria would only sell potatoes and beef produced by Austrian farmers. I've translated sections of the so-called sustainability report published by McDonald's, hardly a corporation that is known for its environmental responsibility, hardly a corporation that is known for its fairness towards its employees, if we think about recent strikes in North America and in the States. And yet here it talks a localist discourse. It talks about not only using local produce, but it talks about assuming responsibility for Austrian farmers and all the rest of it. In Britain, that took a lot longer, interestingly. And I'll have an explanation for this, which I'll share in a minute. In Britain, that took another 5 or 6 years. All of a sudden, the British outlets, the McDonald's outlets in Britain, were discovering British potatoes and British beef. If I had more time, I would want to say a little bit about the Occupy movement. Maybe I'll feed that into discussion if there's time. But what's interesting here is obviously an anti-globalization, an anti-neoliberal movement that kind of responds to the charge that it doesn't have a shared political agenda, and it says, that's nonsense, we have a shared political agenda. We're resisting the market. We're resisting commodification. And I guess what strikes me is that it's so easy to find symbols of the nation being commodified or the nation being invoked as an act of resistance against the market. And I'm finding it quite difficult to find signs of anti-globalization. So where is the kind of semiotic realm anti-globalization movements tap into. And I wonder, I can't help wondering, whether that's part of the kind of perceived weakness in the Occupy movement. Whether it's not a discursive ideological lack, which it doesn't have. It has a very clear sense of ideological direction. Whether it's the semiotic impoverishment, whether it needs, in other words, a series of signals, a series of signifiers that come to act and stand in for the 99%. There's not enough time. We all know Roland Barthes' famous model in mythologies. We all know about his two-layered approach to myth, to ideology. The first order sign acting as a signifier on the second, an ideological layer of mythology. And I guess this is where I'd like us, I'm moving towards my conclusion. This doesn't need repetition, you all know it. We know that the second layer is all about naturalizing history. We know that it's about pretending that which is historical is natural. And we also know that Barthes' analysis only works through thorough contextualization. So his famous example of the black soldier saluting the French flag, of course, makes no sense whatsoever unless we know about the French context, unless we know about the French understanding of the Republic. And I think it's really interesting to bring this into the present. I was in France a couple of weeks ago, just as the new charter of secularism was being released. And of course, we now find ourselves in a different context. We've kind of gone through the debates across Europe about different multicultural understandings, the German model, the British model, the French model. We've had Angela Merkel, topically, pronounce the end of multiculturalism only 3 or 4 years ago. Really kind of coming in line with the French model. We've got European governments across Europe now talking about social cohesion rather than multiculturalism. We talk about community cohesion from Austria to Italy to France to the UK. The new talk in town is remarkably similar, I would argue, to what Barthes detected and could only have detected in a French context in the post-war era. So how do we, I'm bearing in mind Kopitov's point, what can I add to my earlier signs by way of contextualization? I can take us back to the BIAD, rather than I can just contextualize this by saying in the 1980s, Austria recorded levels of patriotism only surpassed in the US. So remarkably high levels of patriotism as measured by various surveys. I can also tell you that this was before the kind of transformation of banal nationalism into neo-nationalism with which Austria became associated in the 1990s. And I wonder whether we need to bear all of that in mind in reading this beer company's advertising strategy. I can also tell you that sport is in a country that used most of the post-war era to really redefine its national self-understanding. Sport, in particular skiing, interestingly, became one of the chief objects of national pride. So that flag and the localities, the context within which it was used, wasn't coincidental. I can tell you about the Union Jack, and we really need to contextualize that, I would argue, in the current and recent rise of UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party. Now, as a European in the UK, I find myself living in a part of Nottingham with a very large and growing Polish population, and I'm pretty sure I and many of my co-Europeans, my Polish neighbours, find ourselves feeling increasingly uncomfortable, to not put too fine a point on this, by the utterly unashamed anti-Europeanism that is pervasive in the UK and getting more and more pronounced. Now, in the late 1980s, Paul Gilroy wrote a famous book entitled There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack. I'm sure many of you have read it. A powerful argument that even the British left was kind of utterly unaware of the racism in some of its attitudes. A kind of banal racism. Therefore, there ain't no black in the Union Jack. Now, I think in the UK, and this is my way of reading this stuff, the Union Jack on T-shirts and bags, my argument would be that there certainly is no European blue in the Union Jack. This is not coincidence for this sign to be as pervasive as it is, and it often sits side by side with the St. George's Cross, the English symbol of nationalism, which carries far more explicit, far less banal connotations of nationalism. How to carry on. But I can't get to my cows now. But never mind. Where are the cows? And maybe the cows need less of a say than McDonald's. And this is where I'm going to leave it, really. A few years ago, Austria had the highest number of... I'm out of time on that. The highest number of organic farmers anywhere in the world. 16% of Austrian agricultural land is used for organic farming. Clearly, McDonald's was responding to that, I would argue, in very, very cynical fashion, by kind of jumping on the bandwagon. I've run out of time. I would have loved to say a little bit about Michel de Certeau, reconnecting that with Baudrillard, and I would have loved to bring Zygmunt Bauman in, actually, at this point in time. Certeau has got this very interesting distinction between strategies and tactics. I would like to suggest that Bauman inadvertently suggests that we need to invert that relationship between strategies and tactics, but I'm out of time. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Professor Axert told me he find your speech very interesting and he rest with us during discussion.
Thank you.
So, I guess hate the rector's office, so it is. Maybe it is not only sacrifice but also pleasure not to be there, but it's pleasure to meet you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.